Hello, this is co-host Robert. This is a rebroadcast of Forgot My Dice episode 12 titled Name Drop What? Part 2 of our Kaiju Incorporated extravaganza. As always, content is a year old and covers topics and news that have long since happened, but feel free to check out the show notes on forgotmydice.com and come and join us on our new home in the Forgot My Dice podcast fans Facebook group.
Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire.
Another episode of the Forgot My Dice podcast. As always, I'm your moderator, Jonathan Edwards, and with me across the table, my Angelius to my Godzilla, Mr. Robert Lundgren. How you doing?
Hello. I'm doing good. I just had something witty to say, and it just totally, you start talking Godzilla, and it just totally, you know, the record scratch in my brain. So tired. So before we get started, I just want to say, because I put a lot of work into these things.
And they are awesome.
They are. Thank you. So freebooters, if you're listening to this, over on our website at forgotmydice.com, there's usually a link attached to this on the website at freebooters.com as well. I do really detailed show notes where I like put in links. Like if we're talking about a Kickstarter and you're like, oh, that Kickstarter sounds interesting. And then you forget what the Kickstarter is called, or we forget to name it again after we're done talking about it, which we do sometimes because we're professionals. if something like that happens, and it's like, oh, it was that second Kickstarter they were talking about. You don't have to go re-listen to the episode and fast forward. Go to our show notes. I list everything in the order that we talk about, and I provide a link. Generally, I provide a link to every Kickstarter. I don't think I've ever not done that. And then, you know, a lot of news items, I cover source. I link to source articles or anything. So we do really good show notes. So just make sure you check out the show notes if you're interested in anything. And also, every time I mention the term pizza cake, I put the recipe on how to make a pizza cake into our show notes. And it makes me smile every time I see that link get clicked on, because when you're on a website, you can see where you get clicks out of. And I love it when people, I'm like, someone's making a pizza cake. But if I can make someone make a pizza cake. Dude, I need to make that pizza cake. It looks amazing. I might cheat and just like stack the Giornos or something instead of doing it like the Pillsbury people want me to, but I don't know.
We have this place called Double Dave's locally here in Austin, and it's kind of interesting. They do like this pizza buffet. Now, mind you, the pizza is just decidedly mediocre, but whatever. You get to eat as much of it as you want.
Is it CeCe's bad?
Yeah.
Because CeCe's is $5 like pizza buffet bad.
It's like just a smidge better.
Okay,
just,
well, that's
just like a little smidge.
It's still better, though.
But they have this dessert pizza that is like chocolate chips on top of cinnamon, on top of sugar, on top of like a pastry crust. And I swear on all that is holy, I almost go diabetic every time I go.
Oh, dessert pizza.
It's so bad, and yet it's just so good.
Show notes, people, and pizza cake. There will be pizza cake. It'll be in the show notes. If you're interested in pizza cake and how to make it, you can follow that recipe and bring a smile to my face when I see you click on it.
And as always, we really want you to be a part of the conversation, so make sure that you're joining us on all of our digital media. We've got a great forum going on at the Freebooters Forum. It's kind of nice. They gave us our own little sub forum for Forgot My Dice, so we can pollute it in any way we see fit. Additionally, we've got our Facebook page and our Twitter feed that we love to interact with people on, so definitely come join us, talk to us, yell at us when we get things wrong. It's inevitable, especially with me around. And
I was the one that screwed up first. We had to do our first Department of Corrections because of me last episode.
That's because nobody's called me on my nonsense yet. I'm sure that I'll screw one up soon.
That's true. I called myself on my nonsense. So,
yeah, that's it. So let's get on with the show, and let's talk about what we've had off the shelf, Robert. It's been a slightly better 2 weeks than the previous episode.
Yeah. It's almost like something happened during that previous 2 weeks of that episode that upset the balance of nature and made it hard for us to enjoy anything.
But now things are returning to ever so slightly normal.
I disagree entirely, but at the very least, I've been able to do some things.
Well, you've been playing a lot of Overwatch.
Yes, I have. So,
I mean, if we were to measure it, I'd say it'd be like a metric ton of Overwatch.
Yeah, I've actually surprised myself at how much Overwatch I've been playing. So they did the Year of the Rooster, which ends tonight, actually. So we're going to talk about it, and then it won't be there for you to, when you're listening to it. But oh well, I hope you're enjoying it, people in the future. But Year of the Rooster is their new seasonal event. It's based off of Lunar New Year. That's celebrating, you know, China, Japan, the Asian countries. And it's one of the things they did for it was they put in Capture the Flag. And I don't know why Capture the Flag in Overwatch, like, grabbed itself onto my brain and just, like, took me to a magical place where I got to play Overwatch again. Because I hadn't been playing for months. But, oh, my Lord. And that's the thing. I was playing a lot of Capture the Flag. And then all of a sudden, it's like, I want to play some normal mode again. So I started playing normal mode again. And then you know, I'm poking around on the YouTube and I start seeing Overwatch videos. And I'm like, I want to watch Overwatch videos again. And then I watched a thing on Sombra. And then now my brain has been, I want to be good Sombra player. So yeah. I have been playing Sombra nonstop for the past week and a half. I checked. I put 6 hours into games of her in the last week and a half.
And for those of you who are not familiar, Sombra is, of course, the new character that was just recently added to Overwatch.
And she's got a very bizarre kit.
Yeah, she really does. I can't quite get my head around her.
Yeah, yeah. She's got some issues. If I had to say it, she's like 90% there.
She needs a slight buff, without a doubt.
Honestly, if her gun was...
accuracy buff.
If her gun was slightly more accurate, yeah. I think it would fix it. But Sombra... she hacks, she turns invisible. The way I play her is I usually try to set up a little base behind enemy lines where I make a health kit that only I can access or my team can access, and she can drop a teleporter, and then I turn myself invisible and I just go harass the enemy, and whenever I start taking damage, I just teleport back.
Nice.
And then just keep going out and just force people to turn around, and if they don't turn around to look at me, then I do stuff to, you know, make Reinhardt's shield go down, and then my team can start shooting at everybody, and it's awesome. And when it works and you've got people who realize what I can do, and I have the wherewithal enough to realize how many of my team are still alive and what they can throw into it, and I make the correct decision, it's amazing. The problem is with her...
definitely a support character, not a frontliner.
Yeah, yeah, but the problem... yeah, I don't know why she's not support, but the problem is, you know, when you're playing solo queue especially... you know, more often than not, things go pear-shaped because, you know...
she's big on communication.
Yeah, she is.
Communication, she's going to...
yeah, and there's not a lot of communication in solo queue. So.
And as you can tell, I've played some Overwatch, too.
Oh.
Any other video games you've had a chance to play?
Yeah, I played quite a few, so...
Oh, jeez.
So, Double Dragon 4 came out on the PlayStation. What this is a company, I forget the company's name, bought the rights to Double Dragon.
So not Tecmo.
Not Tecmo, no. And they took...
no, it wasn't Tecmo. Was it...
I forget who...
Bad Dudes was Data East. Right?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know who owned the original one. So they took all the sprites, actually, out of Double Dragon 2, the NES cartridge, and they sort of rebuilt the engine and pumped out, you know, Double Dragon 4 on the PS4. And, you know, I've been playing it with my five-year-old, and... we just run around and beat up bad guys and do, you know, spin kicks and all that jazz. And we have a good time. And she's getting a little disheartened because we haven't beat the game yet. You know, yeah, and it's
Double Dragon. It's meant to be hard.
Yeah, I know. She has not experienced Nintendo hard in her life yet, but she is getting the taste now.
Yeah, kids these days, they don't know Nintendo hard.
They do not know Nintendo hard. But it's been fun. We go, we beat up bad guys. We do silly stuff. We're having a good time. It's Double Dragon. And it's funny because it looks like a Nintendo Double Dragon, except, you know, you don't have that weird sprite clipping when you have more than like three things on the screen on the same row.
Yeah, because you've actually got a processor that can handle it.
Yeah, but it's also widescreen, so it's weird seeing like these really old, like, you know, 8-ish bit Nintendo levels and beautiful, glorious widescreen.
I bought recently, well, I guess it was over a year ago now, I bought one of those little Sega Genesis from Target.
Yeah.
And so I set it up and I was playing the games with Carlos. And first of all, he went through the whole, I don't understand what I'm looking at here because this isn't like beautiful 3D. And then once he got past that and started enjoying them, I think he's starting to actually prefer those games.
It's interesting because my five-year-old doesn't care about that stuff because she has her own iPad. And so she plays app games, and a lot of app games are throwback games with,
that's,
you know,
true,
8-bit
that's
graphics,
true.
And it doesn't phase her at
See,
all.
Carlos is old enough that
he missed that cycle. Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting because Chloe doesn't blink at it either, and she's only 2 years younger than Carlos, but it's enough to kind of bridge that gap.
Yeah, yeah. And also a lot of app games are very simplistic, so the simplistic sort of rules of an old 8-bit game.
Well, we were playing Streets of Rage.
Oh, nice.
And we were having a grand time. He just, like, the concept of a beat 'em up was just perfect. We were having a blast.
Last episode, we talked about the company that's been converting Neo Geo games over to the PlayStation. So World Heroes came out, which was one of their responses to Street Fighter.
Yeah.
And my personal favorite, mainly because the 7-Eleven that I went to a lot when I was a kid did not have King of Fighters. They had World Heroes. So that is what I ended up playing a lot. And it's got the dumbest story ever. whatever. It's
just terrible.
I think the dude's name is
not even that great of a game, as I recall.
No, it's not. It's awful. So this dude named Doc Brown, I think it is actually Doc Brown, travels through time to get the best fighters to fight each other to see who's the best.
And it was a great idea when Eternal Champions did it too, much later, and that also was a terrible game.
Yeah, but I've been playing, you know, old school World Heroes, and it's been glorious fun. I really wanted a fighting game that, for lack of a better term, wasn't good and wasn't very polished. And oh boy, is that game not polished and horrifically unfair. And I'm playing it again, and Rasputin, I could never beat that dude because the computer cheeses him so hard.
So bad.
So hard.
And those moves that you literally cannot chain together with a controller.
Right. And just experiencing that again on my PlayStation and just wanting to choke my controller or choke my PlayStation 4. Like, I wanted to choke that stupid thing in the 7-Eleven in the 90s. Oh, it's so good. So, yeah. World Heroes, Neo Geo on the PS4. So good. Can't wait for the sequels, because they had four.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, three. There was World Heroes, World Heroes 2, World Heroes 2 was, Jet,
there,
and then World Heroes
was
2 Perfect.
Big Neo Geo crossover games, like... Where
the King of Fighters games, yeah.
Yeah, those were fantastic.
Yeah. They have one of them on PS4 as well.
Oh,
I think it's King of Fighters...
Don't tell me that.
It's King of Fighters 2000, I want to say.
So I've had some video games out as well. I played some Overwatch because I wanted to try the Year of the Rooster. I played some Battlefield 1 because I play a lot of Battlefield 1. And I actually did get a chance to sit down and, of all things, Carlos and I had an opportunity to sit down and we started playing through the Force Awakens Lego game.
Oh, nice.
Oh, that crack is hard, man. That crack is hard. Because now I want 100% that thing so bad, and I fully acknowledge in my head that really, I mean, honestly, at the end of the day, it's a simple, not that awesome game, but it's got me, man. I want 100% that sucker. I want all the little mini kits. I want all the little studs. I want everything.
Does it verge from the Lego gameplay, or is it just, you know, riffing on the source material and being silly with it?
It's the same thing as the other Lego Star Wars games. It roughly follows the plot of the film, with slapstick comedy, you know, kind of merged in.
Yeah, the Lego thing, yeah.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's fine. It's charming. It's Lego Star Wars. It's fun to be in that. You know, it's a simple game. The kids absolutely adore it. I play it with both of my older ones, and sometimes the younger ones will even come sit down and watch because they have a good time with it. So it is what it is.
My five-year-old's been playing Lego Hobbit.
Yeah.
The funny part is she put it down for a while, and now she doesn't know where she's at because she's in the overmap right now, and she doesn't know where to continue. I think she needs to go...
Lego Hobbit was kind of a hot mess with the overmap. The overmap was too large.
Yeah. So I think she needs to go into the Lonely Mountain, but I'm not sure how to get there. And she's like, what do I do now, Daddy? I'm like, hell if I know, hon. I was not paying... You were playing this when I was not watching most of the time, so there you go.
Now let's switch gears and talk games a little bit. I had a chance to actually sit down with you and play some games.
Yeah.
We played ourselves some Kaiju Inc., which we're not going to go into too much detail. Because
we're not
going to
go into any detail.
In a little bit.
Yeah, we're moving on. Swipe left. Or swipe... I don't play Tinder, so I don't know.
I should hope not.
Yeah, a married man. But whatever. It's gone. It's that way. We'll send it a message later.
Then you kind of walked in just as I was finishing up a game of Santorini with our friend. What did you think just looking down at the table?
You guys were like putting it away when I came in, so I didn't really get to see the table. It looked neat, though, because about a quarter of it was still up when I rolled in. It looked really pretty.
Yeah.
And I was like, let's play that, guys. And you guys, it's not three players. And I'm like, oh.
Well, okay, so to be absolutely fair to the game, there is a more than two players variant. But having read through the variant rules, it's just not going to be as engaging as the two-player game. It was designed from the ground up to be a two-player game. That's where it excels. And I would have hated that to be your first experience with it, because it deserves the two-player experience. So we'll get it out again soon. I've been playing actually a fair amount of Santorini, and I continue to absolutely be infatuated with it.
It's so I should look forward to getting my butt handed to me.
I should make
you play with a handicap.
You won't need to. You'll see why when we play.
Okay. I'll keep because of that dumb way I learned how to play board games. We'll see, because I have to make stupid decisions, and you'll probably just capitalize on them and win.
Well, and then you and I had a chance to sit down and we played Pandemic.
Yeah, old school
classic,
Pandemic.
Yeah.
And the first game.
the shocking.
The gods of pandemic look down and is like, you have not been here for a while. You may have an awesome game, and tapped us on the head, and
that game was perfect.
Yeah,
we could do no wrong.
Yeah, it's like, we really need this to happen. Here you go.
and then in our hubris, we thought to ourselves, we shall play a second round.
We're awesome gamers. We should play this again.
And the pandemic gods looked upon us and said, now you will remember why we are not kind gods.
Yeah, we had 4 turns where nothing could get done.
Oh my God. Because the first quarter of the game was no forward motion.
Yeah.
We couldn't put anything together.
Yeah, because we all had weird amounts of the cards. Like, all of us kind of had these weird equal amounts. And it's like, well, which one should we start working on first? And then it's like, oh, well, I'll start working on blue. I got my 5 blue cards together. And then I pull 2 blue cards that I have to discard. And it's like, why? Why are you doing this? Because we spent all this time trading cards. Yeah. And then I just get the cards I need. And it's
Then, of course, it does the classic pandemic move where it gives you this glimmer, this little ray of hope. And it says, look, I'm about to let you win. I'm so close to letting you win. Look, you've cured 2 diseases and you have a 3rd one. You're going to cure it next turn. And then look at that. You have 5 of the other ones, so you'll cure the 4th one as well. And now I'm going to give you a cascading failure of infection.
Yeah, I think we had 4. It was the 4th outbreak that lost us the game next turn.
Because the 4th outbreak got us also the 5th, the 6th, and the 7th. So yeah. That was the end.
Well, yeah. No, we had the four-peat chain reaction.
Ooh,
it sucked.
Yeah, pandemic very quickly reminded us of why it is just a mean, nasty, terrible game.
Yeah, it was good times.
But yeah, it was good times. It was really fun to get that out again.
I forgot how pandemic giveth, pandemic taketh away.
I've got Pandemic Cthulhu and Pandemic Iberia that I want to play with you too. So now that we've kind of got the pandemic rolling again, maybe we should get those out.
Yeah, totally.
Well, I had a chance to play a couple games without you as well. I got out Descent, and I wanted to test it with the app, mostly because we've been playing so much Mansions of Madness lately. So I tested Descent with the app, and you know what? It's awesome.
Huh.
It's really fun. I was having a good time. The app does a really good job of being the dungeon master, so to speak. Honestly, I think it makes it an easy enough game that with just a little bit of help, I'm going to be able to play it with Carlos and Chloe, my 9 and 7-year-olds.
Nice.
So I think we're going to do a little family run of Descent, which will be fun.
Very cool. I could see that. The core of Descent's not that hard. It's just grab colored dice and roll them. There's not much
but
there.
But there is a lot of crunchiness, especially if you're the game master.
Right, but that goes out the window.
The Overlord.
But that goes out the window with the app.
Yeah, exactly. And then I had an opportunity to start reading through the rules for Masmora. I got the Kickstarter finally from... I kickstarted last year, and that of course takes place in the Arcadia Quest world.
Okay, yeah.
And but it's a completely different game. It's completely different. It uses an interesting system where there are no actual enemy models. Instead, the enemies are represented by dice.
Oh.
And so you toss out the dice, and then you bring the dice forward and have to do combat with the dice, even though you have minis for your characters. And the minis are beautiful. I mean, like, all the Arcadia Quest minis are beautiful, but these are really good as well.
Don't say the minis are beautiful, because I can see the box from where I'm sitting, and I'm going to make you open it.
Oh, I'm going to make you. I'm going to show you. I'm going to show you. What's up?
Ah!
He's neat, isn't he?
He's like a little monk.
One of the characters is like a monkish panda, and he looks so awesome. He looks so good.
He's got tusks.
Hold on, let me show you some more.
Ah!
Yeah, isn't he neat?
Ah, he's got a flying monkey.
I knew you'd like that. That's why I grabbed
him. Or he's a little devil. I don't know what it is. He's got a little flying thing.
These are some of the Kickstarter exclusives that came as stretch goals. But I'll show you the core set. And actually, I do have to say, Cool Mini or Not always impresses me because they have good inserts. They're not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, and they don't usually accommodate sleeved cards, which annoys me. But that being said, they are some of the better inserts, especially the way they handle the minis in the industry. So what I've just handed Robert is the Masmora box, which has this great little thermoform insert.
This guy's got a fro. That's awesome.
Yeah, he's on the cover art as well. If you want to see what we're talking about, just go take a look at the cover of Masmora.
Yeah, it's a warrior, and he's got a fro. That's awesome. I love him.
Masmora is really interesting. It uses smaller dungeon tiles than the Arcadia Quest game, which uses more like Zombicide style tiles.
That's quite red.
And
Gandalf's cool.
Yeah, you can see the dice in there, too. Take a look at the dice. That's how the enemies are represented.
Okay.
And it's just, it's an interesting take. It's in the same world, but it's a very, very, very different game. I cannot
You know what I love about the chibi art style, especially with this one? Like, this one, what I appreciate about it is they're trying to play it straight. So the miniatures have this real like stern, serious expression on them, and you know they got
just helps with the ridiculousness.
Yeah,
of the
they look so stupid. It's like, dude, you're taking yourself way too seriously, yeah. man. Like you got to pull it back. You're I like it.
Well, now I'm going to hand you the best part of the Kickstarter, and I think you can. I'm positive that Cool Mini or Not is selling this as well. If you have missed out on the Kickstarter, and that is the conversion kit. That lets you take all your Masmora guys and play them in Arcadia Quest, and lets you take all your Arcadia Quest guys and play them in Masmora.
I don't know why you think I'd be impressed by this. There's no minis. Daddy likes minis. Oh my god, this bard's amazing.
I had a feeling you'd like him.
Oh, he's like Elvis. He's like, I was so close to doing that once. I was so close to playing Elvis. In the D&D game.
Oh, you should have.
Oh, it almost...
It's not too late. It's not too late.
Got TCB, baby. Let's go get that dragon. I don't do a good Elvis.
Now, here's the greatest thing, Robert. Are you ready? Not but 2 to 3 weeks after I get this Kickstarter in the mail, I get the shipping notice that my Arcadia Quest Inferno Kickstarter is also about to get dropped on me. So not only do I now have the Arcadia Quest and the Arcadia Quest Masmora, but I get Inferno, so I've got crossover gloriness, and I'm going to be up to my armpits in little chibi happiness. And then finally, let's talk about some TV, because I noticed that you continue your Next Generation run. I'm about halfway through season 4 right now.
So am I.
There you go. You've caught up to me. I knew it was inevitable.
Yeah, I'm just at the episode where Riker wakes up and quote-unquote 15 years has passed by, or 16 years.
Oh, you're just like 2 or 3 ahead of me then.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that's episode 8. That's not even halfway, because there's 26.
No, anyway. I guess not.
But yeah. That's exactly where I'm at right now. I've been watching some other stuff lately.
And then what about... what is Steven Universe? I don't know what
that is. That is what I've switched to for the time being. Okay, name drop. Last time Mike Hall was on, I talked about Steven Universe.
That's right, yeah.
It was the third show that I have watched independently of my child, that my child got me into. And I still need to force you to watch one episode, and I know which episode I'm going to pick, because it sets up the show perfectly. But we started watching Steven Universe again, and I started buying episodes, because Hulu only has the first 2 seasons available to stream or whatever. And, you know, so the storyline just kind of ends randomly, and they're like there's a big bad that they're gearing up to fight called the Cluster, and it's a long story, I'm not going to get into it, but you know they're getting ready to go deal with that, and then but they haven't yet, and then that's where Hulu ends, and I'm like, and and my girl keeps getting up to that point, and then we have to start over again, and after like the 4th or 5th time through, I finally just went, you know, because kids can just watch things over and over, but like the adult in me kicked in, and I'm like, I can't do this anymore. I got to pay money just to see these episodes. So we bought 2 seasons now, and we've been catching up on Steven Universe, and that is a surprisingly good show. It's basically a weird superhero show, but it's got a really good mythology, and they're really good at spooling out their mythology in a very intelligent way.
Nice.
And it is a kid's show, and it's kind of a kid's show with a random sense of humor, you know, that you'd see on Cartoon Network, you know, like it's not anything new there, but every so often, like, the show gets super dark. Not like in a bad way, but like in a very intelligent, like, adult way.
Yeah, the Star Wars cartoons have been doing that too.
Yeah, where every so often, like, a character starts emoting, and like, and what they are talking about how they feel, makes perfect sense for everything their character has been through, and is very intelligently written, and is just kind of like deep. And it's like, this is a show my 5-year-old watches and understands, you know, the main plot of like beating up crystal bad guys. But we're watching this one episode, and I was having to explain something pretty complicated to her about she was asking why one of the characters was upset. And I'm like, well, this is adult problems, honey, but here we go. And I had to explain it to her. And I don't know, it's a really, really well-written show. And I've really appreciated it. And it's been nice kind of moving forward. I've been really enjoying Steven Universe. And continuing also, we are almost done with the Gilmore Girls.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm working through season 7. Now, season 7 has had a noticeable dip in quality because due to shenanigans behind the scenes, the original 2 creators of the show were forced off the show.
How many seasons are there?
There's 7, and then there's the Netflix season, which we will watch again when we get there. Yeah, they had to leave the show, and so... And it was the lead writer, too. It was the lead writer and the lead producer got forced off the show. So the witty writing all of a sudden became a lot less witty. Instead of being witty writing, it was trying to be witty writing, and it's just really noticeably taking a dip in quality. But I'm still having I'm having a good time still, but it's really hard to get through those episodes. So
it's always rough when any show that you love has that dip in quality because of an internal shakeup, especially with writers.
But yeah,
Arrow looking at you.
But yeah, I still, man, if that show had dragons and wizards in it, you'd watch it. It's good.
Alrighty, and then finally, I got into a TV show recently as well. I've actually been watching it all season. I keep forgetting to talk about it, but I've been having so much fun with Timeless.
I've heard of it, but I can't place it.
So you have a group of characters who starts going back in time in a little time machine because
right.
another group of characters has stolen a time machine and is trying to wipe out a big, bad, shadowy nasty by wiping it from history. And so they do this by altering history, and the heroes are going back trying to stop them.
Oh, but is the other group not necessarily doing a bad, air quotes, thing? It's just they're screwing up everything?
Well, I'm not going to go into spoilers. I will just say that there are question marks involved.
Okay. Yeah, don't go into spoilers.
Yeah.
Time travel is one of my favorite shenanigans, so I should probably just watch the show.
This is really interesting. It poses some interesting questions about the effects that time travel could have on a time traveler psychologically. And it also... It's been interesting because here you have three people from 2017 that are traveling backwards in time to different parts of history. There's a woman who has to deal with the way women were treated, you know, prior to, say, 1995. There is a soldier who sees things that are outside of the bounds of what he would have dealt with when, you know, being a professional soldier in a modern time. And then there is a character who plays the pilot of the time ship, and he's a physics, you know, genius, and he happens to be African-American. And when he goes back in time, well, I mean, he even says it in the first episode, and this is by no means a spoiler. He looks at one of the other characters and says, no, I don't want to go back in time. When in time is it okay to be black? And, you know, it's really an interesting statement because, you know, he deals with a lot of what we would consider nonsense in 2017. And he, in particular, comes up with some interesting conundrums because they have an episode that centers around Abraham Lincoln's assassination. And he's posed with the concept of, can I stop it? And what would that do for history? And it's just, it really poses some interesting questions and makes you stop and think about the ramifications of some of this stuff and how it could have changed, you know, entire, not just decades of history, but also the way people are treated.
So it's like Legends of Tomorrow, but actually playing it straight instead of goofy.
Yes, yes, very much so. There's no goofiness whatsoever. And it's more interested in the alternate history and taking it into a serious place and asking serious questions. It's good. It's interesting. I've really been enjoying it. I can't believe it's from NBC. Like,
what's up with NBC lately? Because they've been doing, they keep saying it's like, we're tired of making niche shows that are widely reviewed well, but then nobody watches. And then they keep making shows that really would fit that bill really nicely. We're tired of doing
that. The Hannibal experiment. Like, well, Hannibal was brilliant. What an amazing TV show. What was it doing on NBC?
Or Constantine, or Community.
Oh, yeah, no
Kimmy
kidding.
Schmidt started on NBC, and then they passed it off to Netflix.
I still hold a hope in my heart that Constantine comes back.
Because CW?
That show was so well done. Honestly, the best, in my opinion, of all the comic shows that are taking place in that world. It's even better than Flash. But unfortunately, just, you know, wrong place.
I don't think CW will do it because they already have a show like that. And it's called Supernatural and just got renewed for season 13.
I know. There's room for two. There's room for two.
Yeah, I'll just put it in the Arrowverse and change it slightly. It'll be fun.
Well, you know they do crossover.
I saw that Arrow episode. Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Although they did say that is not the Constantine from the show. That Constantine is in some sort of parallel Earth, you know.
Of course he is.
Yeah.
Because DC.
Well, and also because the...
Because multiverse.
Well, they also said that what happened in that show doesn't really jive with what's going on in the Arrowverse. So even though the same actor played him, it is a, air quotes, different Constantine.
Which, according to Flash, if you've watched any of Flash Season 2, you'll know is totally okay and legit.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's the end of our off-the-shelf. What have you had off-the-shelf? We want to hear all about it on all of our digital media. Go take a look at our Facebook, our forums, on the Freebooters Network, all that good stuff, and tell us what you've had off-the-shelf. And next up, we have our Kickstarter and news segment.
And it's packed.
It is packed indeed. So join us after this short break.
Captain, come in. It's a war zone out here. The trolls are about to overrun our position. There's casualties everywhere. No one can have a decent conversation without exploding into flame wars. I understand, sir. The other Mont and I are trying to hold them back, but no matter how many we ban, they just keep coming back in greater numbers. Captain, tell my wife. Free Buddha's Forums. A great place to chat with no trolls and no BS. All gaming, all the time. www.freebuddhas.com.
Do you have a tabletop, board game, miniature game, or RPG that you're going to release for retail?
Or do you have an upcoming tabletop Kickstarter that you're about to launch?
We would love to interview you for a future episode of the Forgot My Dice podcast.
Send us an email to fmdpodcast2016@gmail.com to schedule an interview. And now it's time for Wisdom of Crowds, our bi-weekly tabletop news and Kickstarter segment. And first up on this particular episode is that WizKids has announced a new D&D trophy, which is, looking at these notes, ridiculously expensive.
Well, the last one was $400.
And somehow they've made it more.
Yeah. So what we're talking about is quite a few episodes ago, I don't even know how far back at this point, we covered, they did a Red Dragon, and now they have the follow-up, which is a Mind Flayer, an Illithid. If you're not familiar with D&D, imagine it's Cthulhu. It's yeah. Humanoid with a squid face.
Yeah.
Vaguely humanoid head, bunch of tentacles.
With a cool little Dracula collar.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, that's how they roll. So, but yeah, no, it's really cool. I could see why this one's more expensive because, you know, the Red Dragon was just like, its mouth was slightly open, but this one's like the tentacles are kind of all flailing in a weird way. They're not just like drooping. So it looks really cool. It's a little bit more intricate.
Really good.
Yeah, it's definitely more intricate than the last
one.
Did
you see the weight on it?
Yeah, the last one was 15 pounds.
Yeah, this one's weighing in somewhere between 14 and 16.
The last one was, I don't know what the MSRP was. I saw it on Amazon a few times for $400. And this one, the sculpt is much more dynamic, so I'm not shocked it's more because it's probably more pieces and harder to assemble and paint. But I've seen a whole bunch of pictures, a whole bunch of gaming stores, you know, tweeting out pictures of their dragon head that they have on their wall now. And this one looks even more awesome. So,
did you see what the shipping container is?
No.
It's a custom shipping container that weighs 31 pounds.
And you're wondering why it's $450?
What's the FedEx bill going to be on that?
A lot.
That's ridiculous.
Well, you don't want it to break. It's $450.
Yeah, well, especially since here, shipping and fees are extra. So now it's $450
well,
plus shipping,
order it
so
from
keep
your,
that in mind.
You order it from your FLGS because I know for a fact they can get it. So at least they could get the Red Dragon one. So yeah, you could probably go pre-order this right now and get it through your FLGS. And not have to pay the shipping.
Yes, and apparently they're also doing a second print run of the Red Dragon. So keep that in mind, too, because apparently the first one was sold out really quickly.
Yeah, real quick. Yeah.
And this will be releasing in May, according to the article.
Next up is something that I spotted, and basically it's my shout-out to you people who are listening right now, the people in the future, because between the time we record and the time this comes out, like 7 to 10 days passes. So right now, Planeshift Kaladesh does not exist. However, on February 16th, which is 3 days from now when we're recording, it will exist. But I don't have it now. So I guess we'll cover this next time. But if you were not aware it was there, yeah, go download it. It's probably going to be awesome. And we will see, is my prediction right? Are the inventors going to not be wizards? Or are they going to be wizards? How are they going to do it? Is it going to be longer than the previous ones? The previous ones were like 30, 40 pages. So we'll find out.
Yep.
I'm almost done with the Art of Kaladesh. I'll have to finish that up. We'll definitely cover this next episode because I'm probably going to devour this Cujo-style froth all over my mouth. Probably a little blood.
That's okay. We live near a Costco, so we can get him a industrial-sized box of anti-froth napkins.
There we go. So, yeah, I'm waiting so much. I want this so bad.
Well, as the next item on our news list is something I want so bad.
Yes.
And that is from Eric Lang and Cool Mini or Not, or as they like to now be called officially, Simon. And of course, this is the Rising Sun, which is the spiritual successor to one of my most favorite games from the past couple of years, Blood Rage, which is an awesome territory control game.
Yeah, if I remember from when we talked about this last, when Eric won the Diana Jones Award.
Yeah.
This one is going to have more to do with diplomacy, whereas Blood Rage had more to do with risk. So, I don't know. The Kickstarter's coming, what's the date?
March 7th.
March 7th at 3 p.m.
Yes.
I don't know if that's Pacific or Eastern or I don't know.
If you're one of the first lucky 100, generally CMON puts the first 100 pledges up for $10 less.
But, well, I am sure we will cover this in the Wisdom of Crowds in probably two episodes?
Two episodes, about a month.
Yeah, so, yeah.
But I gotta say, everything that they've released about this game so far looks amazing. It is Adrian Peterson, who's the artist from Blood Rage.
Yeah, it's the same team.
Many other games.
I remember when we talked about this, it's like the same group.
Yeah. But the art is absolutely beautiful. And instead of being Viking, of course, this all takes place in feudal Japan, you know, with a twist, of course, because you've got all the gods that are involved in it and everything that they've released about this game. And if you want to see some great pictures, by the way, go to their Facebook page because they have pictures of the models, pictures of the art. Everything just looks beautiful, especially being the spiritual successor to Blood Rage and that Eric Lang has been on a tear recently. This is so far up my froth list.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for the Kickstarter to actually come out because I want to edit out 5 minutes of me looking at the models going, wow, these are really pretty models, which always happens every time we review one of these Kickstarters that I haven't really gone through yet.
All right, so March 7th, you know where I'll be. I'll be clicking madly on a computer.
Speaking of clicking madly on a computer or frothy games, or I don't know, this segue is eluding me. There's another game up your alley that is coming out pretty soon.
This is from one of my most favorite designers, and that is Jamie Stegmaier. And that is that we finally are getting a bunch of information on Charterstone, which is his take on a legacy game, which is really exciting. Charterstone is kind of interesting because it's a legacy game, but it's meant to be replayed. So while you are making permanent alterations to a game, you can reset it, which is kind of interesting.
So I guess those wouldn't be permanent alterations to the game. They are...
But they've only just recently started to release kind of basically how it works. It's a programmed learning system. So there's no rule book in the box. You learn the game by playing the game, which is kind of interesting in and of itself.
Yeah, I'm kind of intrigued by that notion.
There's a bunch of different crates within the box, and each of these crates apparently have different rules in them, and you end up with a completely different style of game based on which rules you implement from these crates during the course of your game.
Or I am not a board gaming guy like you are, Jonathan, but I gotta say, this. Unless I'm on crazy pills, this is by the guy who did Scythe, right?
Yes.
Scythe was literally the most sublime game board gaming experience I think I've ever had. I really want to play this game now. Scythe is amazing, and this is coming from the same company. There's ways this could probably be bad, but I do have very high hopes. And the whole notion that there's no rule book, you're just supposed to like open crud up and start playing like men, because who needs instruction booklets? I think that's really cool. Like it's a really interesting notion. And you know, part of you goes like, well, how could they pull that off? That's going to suck. But just it's the Scythe dude. Like, how could this go wrong?
Yeah.
That's my thought. How could it go wrong?
And look at the tableaus from Scythe, right? Look at how well thought out they are and how you can, they're actually dual layered cardboard so that you can fit components snugly in. It makes me think that he's probably got something up his sleeve for a way of controlling all these different rules.
But that's the thing. Like when I say it's sublime, like if you haven't heard previous episodes where I've talked about this, the way I learn how to play board games is really irritating because like I have to like feel them out. You know, I can't like look at a board game rationally and just do it. I have to do stupid things. It's like, is this a bad move? I don't know. We'll find out. Oh, yep, it's a bad move. Like I just do dumb stuff like that, and it really sucks because it usually takes me a lot longer to learn board games because of it. And Scythe like played into that hard. I was able to feel it out within like a turn or two. And I got it. Like I got it, and it was like everything that was like a good move was very obvious to me that it was a good move, and it just felt right.
That's the same with Viticulture, which is another one of his games. I went through that with Viticulture where I sat down and I was intimidated by it, and I look at the board, I look at the components, I'm like, I don't even know where to begin. And then by the end of the first turn, you're like, I get it. I see the paths that are available to me, and there are a lot of them, and I see the different ways that I can make this game work for me. And yeah, Scythe and Viticulture are both great examples of that. And I think, you know, we also know that for a fact that this is going to be an amazing production value.
Yeah, yeah. So,
because, I mean, look at Scythe and look at Viticulture. I mean, those are games that have just an absolutely astronomical production value, way beyond what they should be.
According to this, and this is the impressive part, altogether the game will have 350 cards, 230 wooden tokens, and 36 metal coins. So this box is probably going to weigh 50 pounds.
Now, what I really like is that it's going to have branching storylines, which means that every time you play through, because it is meant to be reset, you're going to get a very different experience, which is awesome. Each campaign basically takes place over 12 sessions, and each of those sessions is meant to be about an hour, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's like perfect, because think about it too. Think about like game night, because you could do multiples of them the same day, because, you know, back when we have a typical kind of long game night, we could probably fit 2-3 sessions of that in and then play something else in between to kind of clear the taste buds while you're sort of thinking about the next step.
That's certainly what my legacy group did with Pandemic Legacy. We would do 2-3 sessions in a night, with a little game in the beginning and a little game at the end, just to kind of clear the palate, so to speak. Now, here's the really interesting thing about this. Scythe and Viticulture were both Kickstarter games.
Yeah, and this one, they're not selling it through the website. Nope. It's going straight into the hobby stores.
Which is interesting. I'll be curious to see what Stonemaier has to say about this once the game is out, whether or not this was a good decision. Because he actually has a fantastic blog where he goes in depth into all of his business decisions and how he comes to them, and the results of what works and what doesn't. If you've ever been fascinated by, you know, how does a Kickstarter campaign work, or what works or what doesn't in a Kickstarter campaign, go read his blog, because it's absolutely phenomenal and very, very forthcoming. But I'll be very curious to see if this works out for him, and I certainly hope it does in a positive way.
I didn't know I had a blog, and I love business stuff like that.
Yeah, go check it out.
All right, readers, go to our fabulous show notes that I was talking about, and I will try to remember to link it into there. It'll be a link. It'll be the blog. I don't know. I don't know what I'll call it, but it'll be there. Go look at it.
Yes. So they're shooting for a Q3 or Q4 release this year, so we still got a little bit of time to get extra frothy about it. But Charterstone coming soon. And now some news from a game that we just covered last episode.
Yeah. So Elite Dangerous, the RPG, was on Kickstarter.
Based on Elite Dangerous, the game.
Correct.
Which I did not realize is based on Elite, a game.
Yes. So the Kickstarter was going well, and then I logged into it because I've been keeping my eye on it, and I noticed it got taken down. And so found out some lovely information on it. So the original Elite was made by a group of guys. And then the team kind of went on to make other Elite games, which apparently there's a whole series.
I had no idea either.
And so, but one of the guys didn't go with them. He went off and did his thing. So he basically he licensed his rights to the game to the remainder of the team and told them to go off and have fun. And then what that team did was they made Elite Dangerous, among other things. And then they licensed the Elite Dangerous setting to the RPG company, and then the original guy from way, way back said, whoa, our agreement does not give you the right to sub-license out. That does not work that way. And so the whole Kickstarter came screeching to a halt. And here's the thing. This is not the first Elite Dangerous RPG, I found out. There was another one. It made about 7,000 pounds, which I didn't bother doing the conversioning, but not a lot.
It depends on the year.
It depends on the year, too, exactly. But, you know, I mean, 7,000 pounds, but here's the thing. This one was up into, like, the 60,000 pounds. It had made approximately $81,000 before it got shut down, and we were still, like, a week out from completion. So, obviously, it made enough money that the guy from way, way back took notice, and he's like, whoa, like, what's going on? You didn't talk to me about this, and I guess he probably wants a slice of that, whatever the licensing fee is or something. Like, enough money started floating around that it got on his radar.
It's worth his while.
Yeah, which is where, you know, it's like, guys, when you sign agreements like this, read the fine print. You don't want to come up with this stuff. Because the guy who wrote the RPG also wrote novels, and I'm like, did they sub-license out the novels? Is this going to, like, grind to a halt a whole bunch of stuff? So, I don't know.
That's too bad, too, because I was really looking forward to it. The RPG was shaping up in a really interesting way. And then one final bit of news, and this is actually, I know, one of your favorite RPGs.
It is, yes.
And this has me extremely interested because I actually have the Numenera box set,
yes,
which I really like. And that is that Monty Cook is bringing out a box set for The Strain.
Right. And Monty Cook lately has been doing the 15-day Kickstarters. And if I do my math correctly, by the time we record our next episode, that Kickstarter will probably have 7 or 8 days left on it, which means we probably will not cover it.
Yes.
So we got to mention it now.
Yes. Right about the time this episode will be coming out, on February 20th, the Kickstarter will launch for the Strange boxed set. Now, I can speak from experience here. My Numenera box set is amazing. You get a lot for your money. But that said, you are going to be paying a pretty penny.
Yeah. The days of box sets being $50, like back in the early days of role-playing games, that is long gone. I looked through your box set. It's very impressive. I probably will not be getting into this because I actually own all the physical books, and do I need new copies of the books? But if you did not get into the Strange setting, this is probably a very, very good way to get in. The Strange is, I like it a lot more than Numenera, because it's more conspiracy horror, which is much more my jam.
Yeah.
And the awesome part is, so The Strange is, you kind of think of it as the Matrix RPG, sort of, not really, but there's this, you know, alternate reality called The Strange, and basically all of human thought, like, flows into it, and it's a three-dimensional memory computer system. So if enough people, like, have memories of, say, Sherlock Holmes, like Sherlock Holmes, you know, 221 Baker Street will start forming in The Strange, but it forms three-dimensionally as a three-dimensional image with characters and all of this stuff running around. And so if you know how to manipulate The Strange and navigate The Strange, you can go visit Sherlock Holmes, because he will exist out there in The Strange. And that goes to anything. And the longer something has had a quote-unquote fandom, the bigger its little nugget out in The Strange is.
Yeah.
So really, really old things can have really, really, really large worlds associated with them. And but that's the thing, too. Even multiple copies of Sherlock Holmes probably exist, because there's, you know, people have been reading the books.
Yeah.
So there's that version. But then, you know, Benedict
watching
Cumberbatch.
The movies,
but
watching the TV show.
Yeah, but Elementary, Benedict Cumberbatch,
yeah.
Those might be just a building. But, you know, they're out there, too. And here's the thing, too. Occasionally, people from The Strange kind of gain sentience, which means they start thinking about things, which starts making more junk.
Which is actually kind of interesting, because didn't they kind of tackle that in The Next Generation? Wasn't there? Yeah, there was. There was the episode
with
where
Moriarty
kind of
defeats
got
Data.
Sentient.
Yeah. So it's a really interesting setting, and I love, they have like a fantasy world as part of it, is one of the settings they get into, called Ardun, which has a whole backstory that's crazy, but it's a really, really interesting fantasy.
You've told me a lot about it.
Yeah.
I have to say, I'm completely enamored with
it. Yeah, but that's the thing, like the Ardun setting, like just running it as a fantasy game would be awesome, because they go into such detail about how the setting works and all the myths and stuff in it. So, yeah, no, this box set's going to be amazing. If you haven't gotten into The Strange, like, do it. It's The Strange is a great game. Like I said, I like it way better than Numenera, because Numenera is just kind of, like, weird and bizarre, and it feels to me like D&D with, you know, doing other stuff, but, like, The Strange is really, like, it's way own thing, and it's...
That's backbone by the Cypher system, right?
Yes, yeah, it'll be back...
Which is a really cool system.
Yeah, it's the same system as Numenera,
yeah.
So, and it's a lot closer to the Cypher system rulebook than Numenera was. So a lot of the generic Cypher system rulebook things, because since you hop around The Strange, you also kind of hop around genres, so you can actually get superpowers, which is kind of rad, and then you can go to another world and become something else. It's a bizarre game, but it's awesome. Check that out, The Strange box set. The Kickstarter launches on February 20th, and knowing Monty Cook Games, it will be 15 days. So mark your calendar, make sure you get in on it. It will probably be rad.
All right, so now we turn our attention to the Kickstarter area of our show. That is our Kickstarter news, and let's start with something a little fun. And this is this guy, I think, caught both of our attentions because of our friend of the show, Mike Hall, backing it.
Name drop. What?
Thunk. That is Campy Creatures. So this is from Keymaster Games. It's a 2-5 player game that takes about 20 to 30 minutes to play. It's $20. Which is amazing.
And here's the thing, here's what caught me on it. It's inspired by, I don't know where I've seen this art before. Like I had a puzzle when I was a kid of a mummy and it was in this art style, but it's this old like 70s sort of art style of monsters. And when you see it, you like recognize it. You're like, oh, it's those things, you know? I remember them, but I can't tell you where I saw them. Or where this art style is from.
It's slightly comic, but with a different bend in terms of like lighting and stuff. It's almost like the palette you would see in a 50s genre poster.
It's not even 50s. It's more like a 70s thing. Because it I don't know, it reeks to me of like 70s, like a game that was made in the 70s for some reason. Not like rules-wise people, but like just, you know, art style and all of that. Like just kind of this weird throwback to kids' comics and stuff from the 70s of monsters. But it's got all the classics. You know, there's vampires and werewolves and Gilman and all the universal staples.
The Beast. Which is King Kong. You've got a kaiju who is reminiscent of Godzilla. A vampire, a werewolf, the invader, who is your classic alien.
Tentacled alien, if I remember correctly.
The mummy, the invisible man, the swamp creature, the blob. So you get 5 creature decks. You get something called the mortal deck, which is slightly smaller. There's an actual board, which helps to track the clash between the two. And you get player markers and score trackers. And it all fits in a tiny box for $20. And that includes, I might add, shipping in the U.S., which is a phenomenal deal. There's a print and play on the Kickstarter, should you want to give it a shot first. I mean, it's worth it for the art alone, but I did watch the gameplay video, and it just looks super fun. It's super easy. It's something you can probably play with older kids relatively easily. And it is funded. They were asking for $15,000, and they're already well over $25,000 with 3 weeks to go.
Nice.
Yeah, so this is definitely coming. when Mike backs something, that really does catch my attention because he's got pretty good taste.
Yeah, yeah.
In following him for a little over a year now. This looks amazing and right up my alley in terms of monsters and whatnot. So that is Campy Creatures from Keymaster Games. It's on Kickstarter now. And let's now turn our attention to something a little bit different. And this is something right up your alley, Robert.
Yes, yes.
I can see your froth all over the show notes.
What we're talking about is treasure decks for 5th edition. What they are producing is 5 decks of cards. The cards each have sort of a level range. The level range is one deck is levels 1 through 4. The second deck is 5 to 8, 9 to 12, 13 to 16, and the final deck is 17 through 20. And
I really like that they broke that out that way, by the way. That's really clever.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just when you want to like get treasure, you know, for your players or whatever, you just have a card, you pull it out, and then the card usually has a multiple thing on it that you can just roll dice or pick or whatever you want to do. And that's that, you know? And so
I've got to say, from personal GMing, things like this are a huge boon.
Yeah, exactly. It's to help generate stuff, especially if you're making up adventures on your own. Just using the tables in the DMG isn't always as useful, and this breaks it down a little bit easier for the level ranges and what you should probably be giving players at those level ranges.
Now, this is by Nord Games, and they have had a couple of other Kickstarters around 5th edition content as well. This is a great idea. I think this is a great implementation. They've been successful in the past, and this looks awesome. How much is it?
$12 a deck, but if you get the whole set as part of the Kickstarter, you pay $50 and get the whole shebang. Which 5 times 12 is 60, so you're getting $10 off. So, ain't a bad deal.
That is Treasure Decks for 5th Edition from Nord Games. That looks awesome.
Next up, we have a board game called The Shared Dream.
This and looks so awesome.
You sent this to me. And I did the thing I always do with board games where my it started talking about the rules and my eyes kind of just glass over because I'm like, I don't care about board gaming rules. I'm not a board gaming guy. But then there were pictures of models. And then Robert came back to the fore. It's like, ooh, pretty models.
It was the killer clown, wasn't it? That's what really pulled you in.
Actually, the one that got me in was there's a psychic model and they did something interesting with the powers of it. Instead of it making it look like, you know, woo, wispy energy around her, they made it look very like pixelated. And I'm like, dude, that'd be awesome on a 3D model. Yeah. I was like, that would be really interesting to paint. And I was thinking about how to paint it, and I went down this whole like JD moment from Scrubs in my head where I was like imagining painting that. And yeah.
Was there a swoosh?
Yeah, there was the swoosh, and I kind of like look off to the distance. And my wife was sitting there, and it's like, yeah, he'll be back in 30 seconds. Come back, it's like, dry brushing's just not going to take care of that.
So this is a game from Odom Games, and it's called The Shared Dream. It's a 1-4 player cooperative game, and that is based in the world of Odom Publishing's RPG, Dreams and Magic. Basically, your group of characters wake up in the exact same terrible dream, except that it's not a dream. It's actually coming to life in the real world. So the game is completely cooperative. It's scenario-driven, which is kind of neat. Kind of similar to like a Conan or whatnot, where every scenario is a
self-contained story.
A self-contained unit rather than an overarching campaign. Now, what's cool is that the city that you play within is modular. So that's going to change with every playthrough, even when you play through the same scenario a second time. You get 6 unique characters to choose from for players, which means that, like any good game, you have to make some choices before you even start, which I really like. It just looks amazing, and these minis are really neat. And it's kind of interesting because there's different personal reflection cards that can alter your behaviors. It's like your character's reflecting on themselves, which is kind of interesting. And just between that and the modular city, and it looks like a genuinely interesting game. So I'm really looking forward to this. This looks good. So the base pledge is $65. That gets you a copy of The Shared Dream and all the stretch goals. There is a $100 Ultimate Dreamer pledge level where you get a bunch of expansions along with the core game. Those are, of course, being sold separately as well for people who want to piecemeal it. There's a bulk level pledge if you own a hobby store. $450 gets you 6 copies of everything. This looks interesting. They're doing some neat stuff. I like that it's based off of an RPG. I really like when they have different games and different genres that cross over. That's great.
Well, in RPGs, it's all about like building a lot of myth and continuity. And yep. So it gives you a lot of stuff to draw things out of.
All right. So that's The Shared Dream from Odom Publishing. Looks really good. 17 days left to go on the Kickstarter as of recording. They were looking for $30,000. They're sitting at 74, so it's definitely coming out.
So I saw this today, and I haven't had a chance to look at it yet, but the name alone, based off of some current events, which, oh boy, can we talk about, but that's not what this podcast is about.
And that is alternative facts.
the card game. So this is interesting. This came up on my feed because I backed something from Frog God Games. And Frog God Games, previous to this, all they did was, or they did RPG stuff. And just based off of current events, they put this game together to make hay
Have
off of...
Have you seen some of these cards?
No.
Australian does not actually exist. That's one of the cards.
Yep. Alternative facts. Hashtag alternative facts.
The art's great. It's got a little, like, almost like childish drawing of a kangaroo, and there's a giant red circle with a slash through it over the top of it.
Stop me if I'm wrong, Jonathan. The vibe I got out of this is it reminds me a lot of, you know, your Cards Against Humanity, your Apples to Apples, Super Fight. You know, it's one of those things where you just gotta... You get alternative facts, and you got to come up with the best one, and the best explanation, and somebody judges it. Sounds like how it works.
It's a party game. It's very light. It's pretty straightforward. It's not particularly expensive either. You can get a PDF version of it for $10, or you can get a printed copy for $20. It's a simple game, but I think people can have a lot of fun with it, given the nature of the game.
Yes. That's Alternative Facts by Frog God Games. Last but not least, this is something that came across my plate. And I all I did was I saw this and I read the first paragraph of it and I sent that off to my wife, my lovely wife, Gina. And she came back to me with it and she's like, oh, this looks interesting. And anytime my wife starts kind of expressing out loud that maybe we should back a Kickstarter, there's something to it.
You haven't hit back yet.
Yeah. Oh, we're flirting with it. Trust me. We are flirting with it.
Can I throw my weight behind it? I fully support you getting this because I'd like to play this.
So the game is called Bedlam Hall. And in the description, they say it's like Upstairs, Downstairs or Downton Abbey meets the Addams Family, the role-playing game.
Yes.
I would throw in the card game Gloom on top of that.
Yes. Yes, definitely.
The art style especially reminds me a lot of Gloom.
It reminds me a lot of The Bloody Inn, too.
Yes. So the setup of the game is you are the serving staff of a Victorian household, and the nobles that you work for are nobles amped up to, like, you know, 11 and weird, you know, so like working for the Addams Family or people who might be, you know, into occultism and sacrificing people to things that actually work. That could happen in this game, but you are their servants. And what you do and what the game seems to be all about based off of looking at one of the playbooks, because this is it's an Apocalypse World game. It's all about basically stabbing all of the other players in the side and trying to figure out what their secrets are while protecting your own and gaining status with the family so you can, like, put the other servants down. So oddly, it's a PvP RPG where everybody's out to make alliances and break them and shank each other in the side. But instead of, like, you know, murdering each other, because that's not what the game's about, it's just about gaining and losing prestige and standing.
It is Gloom. It very much is Gloom.
Yeah. So it sounds intriguing. Like I said, it's the Apocalypse World engine, so it's roll 2d6. You want to roll higher than 6 and below is failure, 7 to 9 is succeeding, but at a cost, and then I think it's 10 plus or 9 plus, I forget what it is in the Apocalypse World, is you did good. You get everything. You get all the cool stuff. On the Kickstarter, they have a playbook for the butler, which is a real interesting read because, you know, I'm most familiar with Dungeon World, the Apocalypse World D&D variant, basically, which, you know, is all about murder hoboing. And so, like, yeah, there's not a lot of stuff about hit points or anything. It's just all about, like, you know, the butler, like, one of their abilities is you can walk into a room and roll a test and you can see if anything's been moved. Or actually, it's several things, and based off of how you do, you can ask a certain amount of questions about a room, but it's like, has anything been moved? Has anything been switched around? Who was the last person in this room? Yada, yada, yada. And then the butler has an ability where you can straight up order the other characters around, because you're the head butler. you're in charge of the staff, at least the male staff and the kitchen staff, but you're not in charge of the maids. You gotta go get the head maid for that. So it's one of those kind of high-concept role-playing games where I don't know how well it's going to work in practice, but it sounds fascinating, and it's pretty cheap. I think it's $20 to get the print copy.
Yes, it's $15 for the PDF variant, $25 for a print copy.
$25 for a print, yeah.
You really can't go wrong there. That's a good, aggressive price.
And you only need 2d6 to play it. You know, you print off some playbooks. I mean, the Apocalypse World games, once you sort of get them, they're pretty easy to play.
I love this image that they have here and the subtitle they have on it. It's a maid on her hands and knees washing a rag in a bucket, and there's just a half-smeared / cleaned blood stain on the wall. And beneath it, it says, Miss Bluntmore dutifully cleans up from last night's unfortunate cotillion incident. That's just perfect. So, yes, this looks amazing. It's well on its way to funding. There's 29 days left, and they're asking for $6,600, and they're already at $4,400. So, yeah, this one's a shoo-in at this point. That is Bedlam Hall from Monkey Fun Studios.
Monkey Fun Studios. That's a great name, too.
They've coined a new name here, the Dreadpunk Tabletop RPG. That brings us to the end of the Wisdom of Crowds section. As always, should you have any news or Kickstarters that we should be aware of, definitely hit us up at fmdpodcast2016@gmail.com.
Also, I've been putting a thread over on the Freebooters forums.
Yes.
So
come join us on the forums. We're having fun.
So if you go to the, because we have our own subsection. How cool is that?
Yes, indeed.
So I do post that we're getting ready to do an episode. So if anybody sees anything, you can respond to that post. So far, nobody has. And we will definitely look into it. So coming up next.
Yes, coming up next after a short break.
We are going to put on our swim caps and dive deeply into Kaiju Incorporated again, but this time, the card game.
Yes, so prepare yourself for Kaiju hijinks right after this. And now a quick message from our sponsors, Geek Nation Tours. And what an amazing tour they've got coming up at Gen Con 2017, which is, of course, the 50th anniversary of Gen Con. Now, along with hanging out at Gen Con, which is epic in and of itself, this tour is going to have a zombie theme. You're going to get a chance to meet Mantic Games, creators of the Walking Dead All-Out War game. You're going to get an opportunity to play with Hunter Games Outbreak Undead, which is an epic game where you're actually going to have an opportunity to try and survive a real-life zombie apocalypse as you try to return to the hotel from the convention center. Along with all this, you'll also get an opportunity to play the game Zombies, the game Zombie Dice, and you'll get a chance to try out the new Steamforged Games Dark Souls board game based on the amazing video game. So to learn all about that and so much more, head on over to geeknationtours.com and take a look at what's available. We love getting feedback, so please let us know how we're doing by doing one of the following.
You can email us at fmdpodcast2016@gmail.com.
You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/forgotmydice. We post all our articles there, so feel free to comment, or you can message us directly via the Facebook Messenger.
We also have Facebook comments enabled for all our posts at forgotmydice.com.
You can also message us or tweet us on the Twitter. Find us at ForgotMyDice.
You can join us on the Freebooter Network message boards. Find your way there by going to freebootersnetwork.com and click on the Freebooters forum.
If you like the show, the best way for more people to find out about us is to give the Freebooters Network a review on iTunes.
Lastly, for those of you listening from the depths of interstellar space, make sure you turn your controls 18 degrees to the left and flip the intensifier disc on and off again.
Interstellar space?
Yeah, they listen to podcasts on interocitors.
And now it's time for this episode's deep dive, and today we're going to be talking about Kaiju Inc., but not the RPG that we talked about last episode. This week we're going to be talking about the card game.
Yeah, our original plan was to do both in the same review, but then we scored a sweet interview.
Yes,
with Rob, the writer of the RPG.
Awesome.
So yeah, now we have to push the card game to here because we did want to cover both.
Yes. So this is a card game that was designed by Chris Ruggiero and Eric Vogel. And Eric Vogel has made quite a few games that I've actually quite enjoyed. He's made the upcoming Dresden cooperative card game,
yep.
Which
by Evil Hat.
Yes, also by Evil Hat, and I did have a chance to play that at a preview event some months ago, and it was a blast, a super blast. He also made a card game called Don't Turn Your Back, which is based on another Evil Hat RPG system. Eric Vogel makes good stuff, so I was really excited to get into this. Now, as a matter of full disclosure, we do want to let you know that we did receive a promotional copy of this game from Evil Hat for review purposes. We're not going to let that cloud our judgment. We're just going to let you know what we think of the game. But we did want to have that out there just as a matter of full disclosure.
Kaiju Incorporated, the card game. The description is, a 300-foot lizard has just trampled the city. As a business owner, your future is clear. Rebuild and make kaiju skin handbags. Step into the shoes of a company chairman in a land threatened by giant kaiju. It's up to you to turn the shattered remains of your city into profit and prosperity, but watch out for the next wave of monster attacks. Make money, construct buildings, and research products related to the war on kaiju. Collect victory points to ensure your company's domination.
So let's talk about the basic structure of the game here. What we have here at its core is an engine builder. Every player gets to choose one of five different companies in the game. every company in the game is a farcical look at a real company that exists today. Our personal favorite is Monster Santo.
Yes.
Once you pick a company, you get three starting cards. And these cards represent three different tracks of research that you can do and buildings that you can manufacture. And this comes into play a little bit later.
Yeah, and the three different types are there's red for industrial, blue for science, and yellow for construction.
Each of the buildings that you can manufacture has three stats along the bottom. One of them is how many yen it produces. Because to generate money in the economy of the game, you have to have buildings that produce that money. There's a stat for how quickly you advance up your research track. The research track allows you to get cards that will eventually get you victory points.
Yeah, and it represents you researching and producing, your company
different
producing
goods
products
and services based on the kaijus.
So if you listen to the interview of the RPG when we were talking about kaiju burgers and kaiju steak, those are cards in the game that you produce.
Exactly.
Your company has learned how to make kaiju steak, and it gets you, it, some of the cards get you victory points based off of conditions, like how many science buildings, or it's like, it's worth this minus how many of this is on the table, and some of them are just static. Like, kaiju skin handbags are just worth 5 VPs.
A good way of thinking about it is, if you've ever seen the movie Pacific Rim, you're basically Hannibal Chow, the character.
Yeah.
And then the final stat that you find on the bottom of the cards is
The kaiju threat?
Yes. And basically what that represents is, as you are researching and doing business around the kaiju, you attract their attention. And so you advance your track based on this particular stat on each of these cards. And as you advance, eventually you will come around and you will attract the kaiju. And the different kaiju in the game all have different effects, none of which are particularly good for you or any of the other players.
But sometimes, but there is a strategy to it. Because some of the kaiju, for example, one of the kaiju says you must destroy a building that you purchase for 3 yen or less. But if none of your buildings that you own were purchased for 3 yen or less, guess what? It does not apply to you. And if you trigger a kaiju attack, it's like, oh, nothing happens. There's a lot of kaiju that have qualifiers like that. Like, sometimes it's more expensive buildings. Sometimes it's like a building with this tag on it. And it's like, I don't own buildings with that tag. Ta-da, I'm fine. It's interesting that, like, there's some turns where you're like, it's like, can I get a kaiju to trigger? And you're like looking to see, like, how do you attract the ire of a kaiju? There's some high-level thinking there, which I actually enjoyed quite a bit.
Yes. Now, the game is played in a series of rounds, and each round consists of a first player taking a look at the cards that are available in the store. They start out with the number of players plus one.
It's like your average deck builder store.
Yeah, exactly. It's very similar to a deck builder store. And they take a look through those cards, and they determine one that interests them. Now, you only have two actions available to you. You can either purchase that card using the yen that you have manufactured from your tableau.
Yeah.
And if you do that, you add that card to your tableau.
And you subtract the number of yen that it costs to purchase. I think the most expensive building in the game is 9, I want to say.
Yes.
And the cheapest one I saw was 2 or 3.
Yeah, 2.
Yeah, so there's a pretty wide range. Generally, the more expensive they are, the better it is. Because more expensive buildings, sometimes they will reduce the kaiju track. Sometimes they will just trigger, like, some of the 7 yen buildings, it's just like you get research and there's no yen and there's no kaiju. It's just,
which is amazing, because that lets you basically get towards victory points without attracting the ire of a kaiju.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of, the costs involved do a lot of different things, which is really interesting for the game.
Now, the other action that you can take is to scrap a card, and based on whatever color you scrap, that is the track within your own tableau that you activate. And when you activate that, you get to cash in on the yen that are produced by all of the cards of that color that say your turn, and that's important. We'll get into why in a moment. You get to get all the research from your cards in that tableau, and then you also get to get all of the kaiju attraction from that.
And then if, so say Jonathan trashed a red card to activate his red tableau, if you have cards in your track that say rival's turn, if I have red rival's turn cards and Jonathan used a red card, my rival turn cards activate, but they do not activate when I trigger my red. It is only when one of the other players does.
Now, as a player, you can have a lot of fun with that particular mechanic, because if you see that somebody's about to trigger the kaiju and you know that it's going to affect them because that the particular kaiju that's out... and mind you, every single round of the game, you flip a new kaiju, so you're getting a fresh kaiju on the board regularly. You can actually elect to scrap a card, triggering their rival's turn card, which could push them over the brink and have a negative effect on them.
Yeah, like I said, there's a lot of high-level thinking in the tableau stuff, which I appreciated, especially once your engine gets rolling and how you've built your red, blue, and yellow. There's a lot of fun interactions with that. Like, we were playing with your buddy, And I did that to him one turn because there was a particularly bad kaiju and he went before me and he's like, oh, good, I'm fine, blah, blah, blah. But he had a bunch of rivals turn red cards and I really didn't have much red. But I'm like, if I trigger this, he will lose a very fancy building that I am very annoyed that he had. So I went ahead and did that just to kind of shank him in the side, which was fun.
So yeah, that's really the core of the game. You are building yourself an engine that has three different suits. There is the ability to cash in on your own buildings. There's the ability to cash in on other people's turns. And there's just a dash, just a little dash of, you know, messing with your opponent by forcing them to attract a kaiju, for instance, or something.
Sometimes you just somebody will have a lot of rivals turns. And, you know, if you happen to have a lot of yellow, but one of your opponents happens to have a lot of rivals turn yellow, it kind of can mess with your head because, you know, if you trigger it, they're going to cash in too.
Yep.
And you were to my left, so typically you would have a turn after me. And that would get you more money to do things. And so sometimes I'd have to, like, look at the board and go, you know, maybe I should sacrifice something. Maybe I should cash in my yellow so you don't buy a building. But by doing that, it gives you more money and stuff. Like I said, there's a lot of high-level thinking, which is fun. Like, there's a lot to keep an eye on, which is really interesting for this game.
Now, this game does two things that I really, really like, and I'm a big fan of. Number one, there's multiple paths to victory. The victory points are calculated at the end of the game, primarily based on the products that you have managed to research. So it behooves you to really generate a research-friendly tableau that really pumps up your research and gets you lots and lots of those cards. Just like a game like Seven Wonders, like the guild cards, many of these games have multipliers based on specific components that you may or may not have in your tableau. And sometimes it actually behooves you to take a product like that because you're going to be preventing somebody else at the table from getting it.
One of the other ways you get victory points is every starting corporation has two other ways to get victory points.
Yes.
The first one is every building has a city that it is from somewhere around the world. There's only a certain number of them. I don't know what the exact number is, but, you know, cities like Melbourne or Tokyo or, you know, Washington, D.C., stuff like that. And for the number of different cities that you have in your tableau, you get a number of victory points, and the more
which
the merrier.
Which goes progressively higher, exponentially higher,
yes.
The more differentiation you have between cities.
So the track is, it starts at zero, so if you only have, you know, one city type in your deck, you get no points. And then it goes up to 1, 3, 6, 10, 14, 17, 19. So your buddy got a fair amount of points because he had the most. He had five different cities, if I remember correctly.
Yes, yes.
Which was quite the spread and got him a pretty good chunk of points. And then every corporation also has another one. You get five bonus points for having the most of a specific city in your tableau,
yes.
Which is kind of, I like that because it's like, try to diversify, but also try to focus. And so you got to figure out, like, where's the cost benefit for you in that. And
actually, I'm really glad that you said cost benefit, because that's really a key component to a lot of the gameplay decisions that you make in this game. It's all about, this is going to cost me this, and it's going to cost me potentially points, because it also gives the other players access to this. But long term, here's what my potential benefit.
It's almost like you're running a corporation.
Yeah, yeah. It's really kind of clever in that respect.
Yeah.
It really captures the theme.
Yeah, ultimately, I really like the game because it's very simple. But there's a lot going on that if you are paying attention to a lot of the nuances of what the other rival corporations are doing and whatnot, there's a lot of high-level thinking and there's a lot to engage you with. And I appreciated that. That made the game very interesting because it was a lot deeper than your average card-based $20 game like a Guillotine or, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Or no, Dastardly absolutely. Dirigibles or something. Like, really paying attention to what your opponents are doing is very vital to winning the game as well.
Honestly, I think you've hit upon one of my favorite aspects of the game in that it is a reasonably priced game with a high amount of depth. And that's something that you really don't see very often. Generally, you're looking at spending anywhere from $30 to $50 to get this kind of depth, and having it in a $20 package is unique and interesting. Another thing to talk about is just the general art style of the game and the sense of humor of the game. The art is very clean. It's almost a just shy of anime comic book style. It really suits the flavor of the game very well because the entire game is, in fact, a farce. Everything about it is farcical. And so this art style really blends very well with it, I thought. And some of the product cards are genuinely funny.
If you didn't hear last time, the same artist actually did all the art for the RPG as well. And so some of the art is just lifted off the cards, but some of the art in the RPG is new. So if you like that stuff, go check out the RPG. There's more in there.
So let's kind of move into components for a moment, Robert.
Well, let me ask you a question, sir. Since you were the one that did this, how was that rule book, speaking of the components? Because you read the rule book and then you taught it to the rest of us. So how did that read?
So the rule book's kind of interesting. It's a little bit hit or miss. This is one of the few misses within the game. The rulebook does a good job of teaching you the basic components, but then it kind of meanders through some of the crunchier aspects of the game, and it really does not do a very good job of defining order of operation, which can come into play based on some of the card effects, especially around, you know, when somebody triggers a kaiju versus when somebody triggers a research track, or modifiers that the research track or modifiers that the kaiju bring into play. And this, the order of operation can drastically change outcomes sometimes. For instance, a kaiju might destroy one of your buildings. Well, what do you rectify first? Do you rectify the research track or do you rectify the kaiju first? And the rulebook does not do a very good job of implicitly stating what that order of operations is.
We eventually figured it out, but we had to kind of poke around a little bit. I remember that when that came up.
Are the rules all in there? Yes. Are they laid out well? Not particularly. And there's no index, which is, even in a short rule book like this, very frustrating. Because anytime you want to reference anything, you have to start paging through.
And let's be fair, there are 11 pages of rules. So it doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're trying to answer a question of where does this fall on the stack, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, especially since the basic game is relatively straightforward. So that means that there's a fair amount of little crunchiness in that those 11 pages. Now, as far as the rest of the components go, I found them to be about what you'd expect from a $20 game.
Yeah, it's a card-based game. You know, good or for ill, the cards feel fine. They're nice and thick. They're slick. Which was a little annoying on your table because you try to pick them up and you're like doing that card thing. And it's like
I would have liked to have seen a linen finish. I would have liked to have seen something that would maybe hold up a little bit more under extended play. But I think when you look at the price point, you get a decent card stock for that price point.
And you can just sleeve it.
And the box itself is relatively small, does not take a lot of shelf space up. It does come with a bunch of cubes, which are nice little plastic cubes. Everybody gets 3 different colors of cubes, a red, a green, and a blue, and we use those to track our research track, our kaiju track, and how much money you have in the bank at any given time. Now, this is one of the things that I wanted to complain about, because it just uses a standard card to build your tableau. You have one card that represents your yen, how much you have in the bank, and tells you what some of your individual victory point conditions are. And then you got a second card with 2 wheels, one for the kaiju track and one for the research track. These cards are very small. It's very easy to get things knocked around and forget where you are on the track.
Yeah.
And I would have liked to have seen these made out of cardstock. And I'll be 100% honest with you, Scythe has kind of ruined me in this respect because I would have liked to have seen wells for your cubes to sit in.
That would have dragged the price up by at least $15.
Exactly, yeah. It's something to kind of keep in mind.
If somehow they could have printed them on a super card that was like the size of the entire box, so you didn't have 2 separate cards.
And like maybe a tarot-sized card would have really just fixed this problem.
Yeah, and just made everything a little bit bigger. Because, there's also not a lot of room. So sometimes when you're in the middle of play and you're like going, because the kaiju track and the research track are wheels.
Yes.
And so every time you pass go, that's when you trigger a kaiju attack, that's when you trigger you making a new product. You know, if you get 4 kaiju points and you're only 2 points away from triggering the kaiju, well, then you just move past that and then you're that much closer to triggering it again.
Yeah.
But it's really small, so sometimes when you're in the heat of the game, sometimes you can just kind of miss a little bit where you're, and you're kind of on that line. It's like, was I on 2 or was I on 3?
Yeah,
if it was just a little bit bigger and had a little bit, because the cubes are like King of Tokyo size, like they're tiny cubes.
Yeah, they're
so like
small cubes.
So having space issues with that at that size means it probably should have been.
I really do feel like, honestly, all that this game would have needed to fix this would have been just a tarot size card. I think it would have been just enough extra room to lay everything out a little easier.
Yeah, and then the other problem with these cards too, which we haven't talked about yet, is on when you build a building. And when you resolve effects on the building, the first thing you resolve is the buildings give you money, which is on the left side of the card. In the center is the research, and then on the right is the kaiju track. But your cards, when you look at them, your corporation has your bank, which is the green, and then you go over to your second card, and then it's the kaiju track, and then the research track. And that was driving my OCD insane.
Yeah.
Because
there really was no reason to have it be completely opposite of the other one. It's just
if they just flip that, because the way the game's set up, you read left to right. You know, you do the left, the center, the right. When you're doing those effects, you go left, right, center. And it's just...
It would have really helped to clarify the order of operations.
Yeah, it's just this weird little disconnect. And it's like I said... I feel like we're getting stupidly nitpicky here. Literally, this is like the only things we can think about to really complain about in this game. It's just some of this stuff just wasn't thought out quite enough. And given the tarot size cards would probably drag the cost up. And do you really want to do that? I don't know. Could it have been paper instead? That wouldn't have been nearly as cool. But then again, it would have maybe helped with the space issues. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm sure when this game comes out, I'm probably giving somebody out there a lovely idea on BoardGameGeek. I'm sure somebody will make a printable thing that
it does seem inevitable, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So somebody make a really pretty one, go put it on BoardGameGeek and help us all out here.
Let's talk a little bit about another thing that kind of came up that we've talked about several times, and this is pretty universal with every play. Now, we have not had an opportunity to play with this with five players, and my suspicion is that this particular problem would disappear with five players.
We've played it with three players twice now.
Yes. The length of the game is determined by the stack of product cards that you're doing research towards.
And the last five product cards are kaiju skin handbags.
Yes.
And the kaiju skin handbags are what trigger the end game.
Exactly. So every time somebody gets a card, you pull it out of a store where these cards are. There's three up in the store at any given time for people to look at. And then you instantly draw another one and replace that in the store. So that means that the moment you burn through the deck and display one of these kaiju handbags, that is the beginning of the end.
Yeah, that means the game lasts one more round and you're done. Or you finish out the round you're on and then you're done. But here's the thing. When you play with the full deck with three people, the game lasts about like 10, 15 minutes, just a little over its welcome.
It consistently overstays its welcome. You're getting to the point where your engine is built up and you're like, okay, I'm ready to see this end. I feel like I'm in a good place. And then 15 minutes later, you finally trigger the end game. It happened to us consistently at the three-player count. Now, I think if you were to add two additional players that are also drawing from those victory point cards, I think you're going to instantly solve that problem, and I think it will be a perfect duration.
Might be one of those things, might want to experiment if you get this game. If you're having it with less than, you know, five people, you might want to just pull some cards out of the product stuff just randomly.
That instantly fixes the problem, because you can control the duration of the game based on how many product cards you have.
It's just weird, too. It's just like, there's just this point where it's like, this game's starting to drag a little bit, because we're at a place, because I was at a place where I knew I couldn't catch up, because I was losing. And I was just like, I can't win. I'm ready to kind of wrap this up, because there's no way I can come back at this point.
This is something that could be fixed with easily just, you know, a rule in the instructions that says, look, if you have this many players, take this many cards out of the victory deck. If you have this many, take this many out. And you make it completely random so that you never know. That'll give you some good variation. And I feel like that really would have just solved it right there. That would have solved your timing issue. So that brings us to kind of recommended player count. It's an oddity. 3 to 5 players. That means you have to have at least 3 to play, which kind of puts it in a weird spot. There is a 2-player variant in the instruction book. It has massive modifications to the rule set. I haven't had a chance to play it yet.
Nope.
I don't see myself wanting to, based on what I read. I think that the game is better with the larger player count. And I think that it was wiser than to put 3 to 5 players on the box and not entice people to get the 2 players.
Yeah, I agree. And like anything, the more the merrier, I think is the... you should try to play with 5.
4 to 5. 5 really would make the perfect game, but I'd say 4 minimum. 3 stretches it out too long. And then, of course, finally, the most important question. Robert, what did you think? Was it fun?
Oh, yeah. I mean, our nitpickiness aside...
And that's a good sign that we have to get nitpicky with the game, because
There wasn't any like broad stroke thing where I was like, I'm done. This game is dead to me.
No. There's nothing calling out.
No. I mean, we got into it. There's a lot of really interesting high level thinking that you can go to if you really want to.
A surprising level.
Yeah. And, you know, paying it, it's like, if I trigger this, it'll trigger this over there and this over there. And having 3 players was kind of nice, because that aspect of it might get a little overwhelming if I had 4 opponents that I was keeping track of instead of just the
3
people.
3 players does make for a good training game.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to think about. There's a lot to keep track of, you know, and when a good kaiju for you comes up, because there's a surprising amount of them. And that was interesting, too.
Yeah.
As the game wore on, a lot, like, you know, somebody triggered a kaiju on me because they're like, haha, I'll get this kaiju to attack Robert this turn by doing this. And they got to trigger on me, and I was like, okay. And nothing happened.
Yeah.
It's like, when can I trigger a kaiju? Should I do it now? Like, there's a lot of really cool thinking about it. And then, you know, buying buildings and which building to buy and when. Yeah. Is it better to buy a lot of small buildings?
I also like how when you're doing the turns, every turn, the first player marker shifts one to the left.
Yes.
Which means that every time you're first, that means that you're going to be last in the next round.
Right. And you don't replenish the buy pool for buildings during the turn. So it really does alter the game. You replenish the products, but not the buy pool thing.
It gives you the opportunity to look at the people that are coming after you, look at their tableaus, and say, how can I make life more difficult for that person?
Yeah. And I had a really good track record of Screw the Jonathan. That was kind of my goal. It was
and
like,
yet I won. Yeah. So who was doing screwing?
I know who's the threat. Yeah, playing a game to try to screw over your opponent and not really do anything for yourself turns out is not a way to win. Yeah. But yeah, no, it was a lot of fun. I dug the art a lot. Like the art style is very solid. Yeah.
The theme is fun too. The theme is really fun. It's a neat world.
Yeah, the kaiju world is fun. You know, when you're looking at the cards, I get all the references, which we talked about last time, of all the various kaiju, you know, like Queen Conga. And if you're into kaiju stuff, it's very obvious what they're riffing on. And they're very tongue-in-cheek riffing on it.
The sense of humor is great. It's very well balanced to it. Never goes too far.
Yeah, and it's like, this is totally not Godzilla, and that's totally not Gamera. You know, I mean, that's what a lot of these monsters are. And I appreciate that. I dug that. There were often times where, you know, I was really pissed, actually, that last game, because the product pool was fairly far away from me. And I didn't want to, like, keep asking for cards, but I wasn't really looking at them because I wanted to know what they did. Because I'd make that decision if I got one. What I wanted to look at was just the pretty pictures. You know, it's like, why are those giant strawberries on that? And I couldn't really see from my vantage point. So having that desire to, like, look at a card to see what's on it was fun. And then, you know, when buildings would come up, I would, you know, when you look at the art, there's a lot of little hidden Easter eggs in the art. That's a lot of fun.
Yes.
So I really dug that. So yeah, the game, it's got a sense of humor, and the art itself and the product is fun to look at. And then yeah, the game, one of the reoccurring things in this podcast is me saying the words, yeah, it's one of those fun little filler games that I really like that you can play between other things. And honestly, this is almost not that, because it's pretty deep.
Yeah, no, it's much beefier than a filler game.
Yeah, so it plays in like a filler game time, because you can do it in about an hour or less, but it's got high enough level thinking. It's like, this should almost be the not filler game. We should just play 2-3 rounds of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, to get that bigger game feel. I really liked it for that, because it fits in one of those things. The rules are relatively simple, but there's a lot to keep track of. So it's, you know, easy to learn, difficult to master type thing. Which,
yes.
That's the type of game I like. Very much recommend this when it comes out.
I think this game is a little gem. I think that it's a very well-balanced game. When I lost, I never felt like I was completely out. When I won, I never felt like I was completely in control. I like that. I think that the engine building aspect is really clever. I think there's just that little hint of screw your opponent, but it never gets so out of control that it becomes a constant ribbing.
I watch out for games like that, because I've talked about my spike side, where I get mad.
This game, you never really get angry, because it's just the smallest hint of screw your opponent.
Yeah, it's just enough
never
where
out
it,
of control.
You never, it's hard to take personally.
Yeah, no, it really is. It more feels like you're managing your opponent's tableau, trying to help yourself.
Yeah.
Rather than intentionally sticking it to somebody.
Yeah.
I have some minor gripes about the graphic design that make it a little bit difficult to sometimes read some basic information. I think that the cards could stack better in that respect. Again, I'm really digging deep to find some problems here. The only complaint that I really have that could be very easily rectified is that it just overstayed its welcome just a hair. And I feel like the easiest way to handle that is to just remove a few of the victory point cards
randomly.
Or play with more people, and then it'll balance that little aspect of it out. I think that given the price point, it's a remarkable value. You get a lot of deep game for $20. That's amazing. And I love the theme. I think the theme is fun. I think it's great. It's a game that knows the perfect balance between comedy and being serious. And it strikes that balance very well. And it's a joy to have around. Do I see this hitting the table often? Not necessarily. I think it serves a purpose.
Yeah, well, like I said, it's a deeper game, you know?
Yeah.
You don't necessarily go reaching for a pandemic every week either, because sometimes you
just
have the brain power
exactly.
for it.
Exactly. That is by no means a knock on the game. I think that it serves a specific purpose in a game collection. And I'm glad that you brought Pandemic up, because it's the same kind of class of game in terms of depth versus ease of play. I think that's a really good analogy to use. So yeah, I think it's fantastic. I highly recommend Kaiju Incorporated. I'm very, very happy with the way that it turned out. And it's cool because Eric Vogel's made yet another game that has kind of filled a specific niche that I've had a lot of fun with. I mean, ultimately, I think that it's just, it's super fun, especially if you like the theme.
It's going to retail for $20. It should be out exactly at the same time as the RPG, which is also $20. The RPG is not self-contained. You need Fate Core to play it, so, but you can get that for free off of DriveThruRPG, so there's no excuses.
Yep.
It might even be out by the time you're hearing this. It doesn't have a firm release date, but the signs are pointing to its imminent release, like within the next 2 to 3 weeks of our recording date. So it might be out by the time you hear this. I'm sure once it is out, just follow our Twitter, because I'll probably see, you know, Evil Hat tweet it, and then I'll go like, hey, there, retweet, whatever you do on the Twitters.
And that is Kaiju Incorporated, the card game of Monster Profits by Eric Vogel and Chris Ruggiero. I hope I haven't screwed that last name up. And it's being published by Evil Hat Productions. So there you go. Go pick it up. It's good stuff. And that brings us, of course, to the end of another episode of the Forgot My Dice podcast.
The music's swelling over our words.
Oh, in the best ways possible.
Yeah, giving us a soundtrack for our thoughts.
It's a very Gone with the Wind moment we're in right now. As always, we'll be back in a couple weeks with another wonderful episode. Who knows what we'll have in store for then. I'm going to be petitioning hard to get Robert to play Arkham Horror, the LCG, because I really want to review it. And I really want to get it on the table, because that is my jam right now. And beyond that, Robert, any final closing thoughts this week?
I hate you.
Why? Because you don't have any and
no.
I actually remembered to ask you?
Yeah. No.
Well, then let's wrap it up. As always, it's been a pleasure to have you with us, and we look forward to the next episode. And Robert, party on.
Party on.
The music you heard in this podcast was Intro by Elephiel and Retro Funk by Persephone, both used with permission via the Creative Commons license.